This is the Paranormal Podcast with Jim Harrell.
Welcome to the Paranormal Podcast. I'm Jim Harrell, and I'm so glad to be with you today. I'm excited on a number of fronts. Today will be our 299th program on the Paranormal Podcast series, so thank you for all of your support over the last 8 years. We've got a great guest, Dr. Rupert Sheldrake, and we're going to talk to him about the sense of being stared at. I've got a big announcement in the middle of the show, so stay tuned to that. And it's very good, very positive, and something that will be a good thing for folks listening out there if you listen to our campfire show and you enjoy it. And then also, I want to say special thanks about these very exciting people, and thank you so much. I want to say a special thank you to Ed from Japan, Neil, Lindsay, Tom, Tony, Erica, Jennifer, Sarah, Tika, and Charlie. In the last week, they have joined my Paranormal Plus Club. I am very appreciative. They're going to get access to the back catalog of the Paranormal Podcast for those 8 years, all of the back catalog of the Campfire, all of the exclusive episodes we've done on series that have never been free, the paranormal courses, the paranormal forums. So far, I've heard that they enjoy it, so we're so glad to hear that. And if you want to see what all the fuss is about, go over to jimharrell.net. That's jimharrell.net, and click on the big green button. Well, with no further ado, we're going to get on to the program. Our guest is Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. This is a good one. You're going to enjoy it. Our guest today is someone who we've wanted to speak to for a long time, and the occasion is the revised edition of his book. It's called, or one of his many books, The Sense of Being Stared At and Other Unexplained Powers of Human Minds. I'm talking, of course, about Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. He is a former research fellow at the Royal Society and former director of studies of biochemistry and cell biology at Clare College, Cambridge University. From 2005 to 2012, he was director of the Parrott-Warwick Project on Unexplained Human Abilities, funded from Trinity College, Cambridge. He is currently a fellow at the Institute of Noetic Sciences near San Francisco and is a visiting professor at the Graduate Institute of Connecticut. He's the author of more than 80 technical papers and articles, appearing in peer-reviewed scientific journals, and 10 books, including Dogs That Know When Their Owners Are Coming Home, Morphic Resonance, and Science Set Free. He lives in London. Dr. Sheldrake, welcome to the program today.
Pleased to be with you.
Well, I'm pleased to have you because we have had this conversation the 8 years we've been doing this show, that it's called the Paranormal Podcast. However, it's long been my contention that many things that we think are paranormal, actually, maybe a better title might be the Normal Podcast, because many things may be explicable by science, but maybe science at a future date. Now, you're here to tell us that a lot of things that people peg for paranormal are explicable not in tomorrow's science, but in many ways today's science. And I find that utterly fascinating. Now, let's talk about the sense of being stared at. It's something that we all experience. I never really thought about anybody studying it, though. What spurred you on to take a look at the sensation that we've all had?
I was thinking about how minds work, and particularly how vision works. I mean, most people assume that vision was understood long, long ago, and there's no mystery. You know, light comes into the eye, inverted images on the lens, through the lens, changes in the retina, impulses up the optic nerve, changes in the brain. That's all well known, and most people think it explains vision, but the more you think about it, the more mysterious it becomes. It explains how light affects the brain, but then the first thing that isn't explained is why you're conscious. Science has no explanation for consciousness, because physics and chemistry don't explain consciousness. And secondly, everything that's to do with your mind, according to the conventional assumptions of science, is supposed to be inside your brain. So if you look out of the window, as I'm looking now at a tree, where's the image of the tree? Conventional theory would say it's in your brain. I think the image is outside me where the tree seems to be. And this idea that images are projected out as well as light coming in is a very old theory of vision. It's one that modern science has ignored, but at the price of not being able to explain vision itself. So I got interested in where images are, and I came to the conclusion if the image is projected out to where it seems to be, there's a sense in which our mind reaches out to touch what we're looking at. That means we should be able to affect what we're looking at. And then I thought, well, what about the sense of being stared at? We do seem to be able to affect what we're looking at least when we're looking at other people, or indeed at animals. So that's what got me interested, and then I started doing simple experiments that is so simple a child can do them. Thousands of children already have. They've been done in primary schools in Britain, Connecticut, and in Germany. So that's what got me interested, and then I realized this is in fact a parapsychological phenomenon. It's one that has been ignored even by parapsychologists, and yet it's very normal in the sense it's everyone's experienced it all over the world. Animals have it too. It probably plays a major part in predator-prey relationships in the wild. People find they can affect their pets by staring at them. So this whole field of research that had been more or less neglected for many decades, so that's what got me interested.
Now, to be clear, and you touched on it a bit there earlier, these aren't just anecdotes that you've connected, but you've created scientific instruments and scientific, experiments, to measure this and to prove it scientifically, haven't you?
Oh, yes, yes. I'm not just talking about anecdotes. I always start from people's stories of experience because I think science should be grounded in natural history of what people have noticed, what actually happens in experience. But then we have to test them, and there have been two kinds of tests with the sense of being stared at. In one kind, you do them by direct vision. One person is blindfolded, that's the subject. The other person, the looker, sits behind them. And in a random series of trials, they either look or don't look. And in each trial, the beginning of which is indicated by a click or a beep, the subject has to guess if they're being looked at or not. By chance, they'd be right 50% of the time. In the looking trials, they're right about 60% of the time. And it's not a very big effect. It's rather an artificial test. But it's consistent, and it's highly significant when you do hundreds of thousands of trials, which I and others have done. Secondly, people have done these experiments, not I, but others, particularly at the Institute of Noetic Sciences, Marilyn Schlitz, has done experiments where people are looked at through closed-circuit television in a completely different room, and their skin resistance is monitored, as in a lie detector. And when they're being looked at random times, their skin resistance changes compared with when they're not being looked at. This is a completely unconscious response, and it shows that people's physiological responses can detect when they're being looked at. And what's so interesting about these closed-circuit television experiments is they eliminate any possibility of subtle cues. The direct-looking ones do as well, because I and others have done them through one-way mirrors, through windows, and through other barriers that would prevent any transmission of sounds or smells. So I think that the experimental evidence that this is real is very strong now. And, of course, most people have noticed the phenomenon anyway.
Yeah, absolutely, and I have a personal story that I just share a little bit later. But why doesn't mainstream scientists or more scientists take a look at this kind of phenomenon, telepathy and things like that, and say, look, we don't think it's paranormal, but there may be some scientific background to it. Why don't we examine it? Why are you one of the people that look at this and there aren't more of them?
Well, because there's a taboo within science. It's to do with the materialist theory of the mind. Science has been based for more than 100 years on the assumption the mind's nothing but the brain. All reality is material. There's consciousness doesn't really exist, or at least if it does, it doesn't do anything. It's just a kind of glow around the nerve endings. This is a very, very deep-seated taboo within science. In their private lives, most scientists know fully well that these things happen. In public, they don't dare say so because it's a kind of career suicide. And this taboo is maintained by, you know, activists and so-called skeptics who see it as their job to police the frontiers of science. So anyone who does research on these things is instantly attacked. And, you know, it's very hard for people to sustain a regular career doing research in these areas. That's the main reason. It's not because they're not interesting. It's not because most people aren't interested. It's not because they're difficult to test. It's not because the experiments are expensive. It's because of a taboo. And that's what creates this taboo around the entire subject of the so-called paranormal. I mean, like you, I think that the word paranormal is misleading. It means beyond the normal. But actually, the sense of being stared at and telepathy are normal. And they're normal in the sense they happen to lots of people on a regular basis. And they're normal in the sense they happen to animals as well as people. They're not peculiar features of advanced human minds. They're part of the nature of animal sensitivity.
That's a fascinating topic. We'll be back with Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. The book is The Sense of Being Stared At and Other Explained Powers of the Mind, right after this on the Paranormal Podcast. Well, as many of you know, I'm launching my next book on the Amazon Kindle platform. And within the last couple of days, I've come to a decision that I'm very excited about. I'm going to give everybody the opportunity to buy the book for a limited time at 99 cents. Now, it's real important for you to know you do not need a Kindle to read a Kindle book. Amazon provides free apps to read via your PC, Mac, Android, iOS device, BlackBerry, Windows Phone, or via the web itself. So if you're listening to this and got this podcast, you can read a Kindle book. And the plan as it stands now, barring any kind of technical issues or anything, is that starting on Thursday, September 19th at 12 noon Eastern Time, True Ghost Stories Campfire 2 will be available for 99 cents and remain at that price through Sunday, September 22nd. It's a full-length book with 70 spooky stories culled from the Campfire program. It's a really strong compilation, and I'm sure you're going to enjoy it. And after the four-day sale, the price will go up to $2.99 or $3.99. I haven't really decided yet. Now, some people might ask why I'm doing this. Won't I lose a lot of money? And there are really three reasons that I'm almost giving the book away for 3.5 days, and here they are. First of all is a thank you to my longtime listeners. You've been good to me, and I want to get this book into the hands of as many of you as possible. Also, B, if the vast majorities grant the two simple favors I'm going to ask, one of them today, this book will hit the Amazon bestseller list and could be a mega hit. And then C, I think putting it in a very affordable electronic book form will introduce the Campfire program to many people who have never found it otherwise or even thought about downloading a podcast. Now, as I said, I could potentially lose thousands of dollars by doing this, but I have faith in you, my loyal audience. But I have two simple requests from anyone who has gotten any enjoyment from our free programs over the last 8 years. First of all, and this is the one I'd like you to do today, please go to jimherold.com and click on the banner up at the right-hand side of the page for the book. And there you'll be able, once you click through, you'll be able to sign up to receive an email notification when Campfire 2 goes on sale at 99 cents. I know that's important because a lot of times I very well-meaning and plan on buying something at a sale price, and then I miss the sale and I go, well, I'll just forget about it. So please sign up for that email notification so I can clue you in when it's up for sale. And then two, when I send you that email after you've signed up, please buy one copy while it's on sale. Just one copy at 99 cents. Now, at 99 cents, I don't believe one purchase per listener is too much to ask, considering the free content that has been provided for the last 8 years. And I'm specifically thinking of people who maybe aren't Plus Club members, maybe people who haven't had a chance to support us via our sponsors. That's okay. I totally understand, and times are tight and finances are tight, but at 99 cents, I pretty much think everybody that's hearing my voice can afford that. Now, if you want to gift a copy, that would be great. But the two things I'm specifically asking are to please sign up for that email notification today at jimherold.com. And when you get the notification, please buy one copy when it's released at 99 cent pricing. If every listener buys one copy at 99 cents during the sale, momentum will build. This should be a mega hit and a lot more people will know about these podcasts. I thank you so much for your time. I know you'll come through for me. Visit jimherold.com and please sign up for that email notification.
Now back to the Paranormal Podcast.
We're back on the Paranormal Podcast. Our guest is Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. He is the author of many books, including the revised new edition of The Sense of Being Stared At and Other Explained Powers of Human Minds. And today we're not talking about the paranormal, but the normal, which is often assigned to the paranormal, if that makes sense. Dr. Sheldrake, we certainly talked about some of the scientific background. Do you have a couple of favorite anecdotes from the book about people experiencing the sense of being stared at?
Well, one story is a British former soldier who worked in Malaya. And he said he was once in the jungle on a patrol against terrorists. And he suddenly had this feeling of being stared at. He just knew someone was looking at him. And he spun around quickly and found a Japanese soldier aiming a rifle straight at him. Luckily managed to shoot him first, at least luckily for him. He attributed this to just that feeling of being looked at. And this happens with animals as well. Jim Corbett, the famous tiger shooter, he used to shoot man-eating tigers in India for the British government, said how on many occasions his life had been saved by feeling when a hidden tiger was looking at him, the hair on the back of his neck would prickle, and he just knew there was a tiger there, and if he hadn't known, he would have died. I think both of these show that this phenomenon probably evolved in connection with situations of danger in predator-prey type contexts. And these dramatic episodes are a clear illustration of it. I think this kind of thing's happening all the time in predator-prey situations and indeed just in ordinary life for lots of people. It happens most, and or at least most strikingly, when people are being looked at by a male stranger in a place where they don't feel very secure. And that, again, fits with the kind of predator-prey background of the of this sensitivity.
Interesting. In the book, you talk about other unexplained powers of human minds, and you get into different types of telepathy. And I was just driving along the freeway the other day, and I made this observation to my wife, not even thinking about this book. And we were on the freeway, and there was a car up ahead of us, maybe a car length or two. And I said, let's watch that car because he's going to cut us off. And sure enough, he did it. And any of those of you out there who drive have probably had a similar experience where you see a particular car, and not because of anything overt it's doing or any aggressive behavior, but you just have a sense that you have to be wary of them. They're going to cut you off or so forth. And that almost strikes me as a type of telepathy, and that happens all the time. And you talk about telepathy in the book, and it's not anything spooky. It's just very common in everyday life, apparently, from your studies, correct?
Yes. In some of the older accounts of telepathy, people concentrated on the most dramatic incidents, you know, knowing when someone was dying or picking up when someone had had a terrible accident. Now, obviously, those things are relatively rare. But the commonest kind of telepathy in the modern world is in connection with telephone calls. About 80% of the U.S. population, according to our surveys, have had the experience of thinking of someone for no apparent reason. Then that person rings. Then they say, that's funny, I was just thinking about you. That's extremely common. Some people have it every day. And that, I think, is not just coincidence. I mean, this is something that people do find strange and puzzling, don't usually think about it much. But I've found that it is, in fact, much more than coincidence. We've done controlled experiments to test this. The basic experiment, we have four callers and one subject. The callers are people chosen by the subject, someone they know well, and they're usually family members or close friends. The subject sits at home being videotaped on a landline phone with no caller ID. And we pick the callers at random. We call them and ask them to call the subject. So the subject knows there's going to be a call from one of these four people, but they don't know in advance which one it's going to be, and they can't guess because they're picked at random. So when the phone rings, they have to say who they think it is before they pick up the receiver. And for example, they say, I think it's John, and then they say, pick it up and say, hi, John. Now, if it is John, then they're right, and if it isn't John, they're wrong. And by chance, they'd be right one time in four, 25%. Mm-hmm. In these experiments, they're actually right 45%, which is a highly significant effect statistically when you do hundreds of trials, as we have done. I now have an automated version of this test working on cell phones. And if anyone goes to my website, which is www.sheldrake.org, at the online experiments portal, you can register for this. You put in your own name and number and two friends or family members and their numbers. And the whole test is run automatically. So anyone can test themselves for this telepathic ability. Right now, it's readily available, telepathy test available to anyone.
That's absolutely fascinating. And again, I think there's this feeling, and I think certainly pushed by skeptics, that if something like telepathy exists, why isn't it 100% accurate? Why can't somebody who has telepathic abilities, or any of us for that matter, go into a casino and beat the house? Well, as you said, there's a difference between something that maybe a common day might be considered dramatic and something that's statistically significant. Can you talk a little bit, you said I think it was 45%, something like that, the difference statistically between 25%, which is a 1 in 4 chance, which is what we would have expected, and 45%. Talk about how, because for those of us who have studied things like, I studied the social sciences and have a master's degree in it, certainly not a PhD, but that is a huge, huge statistically significant piece of data. Can you explain how significant that really is?
Well, with the number of trials we did, the significance of this result was more than a billion to one, which means to say, if you did a billion of these experiments, you'd only, in one out of a billion times, get this result by chance. In other words, it's very significantly above chance, with enormous odds. But it does raise the question of why it doesn't work all the time, why it's not 100%. We have had subjects who are 100% right. But in these very artificial experiments, people are probably less accurate than they would be in real life because they get performance anxiety. You know, this is a very artificial situation. You have to think about who it is. Normally, these intuitive powers work best when you don't think about them. As soon as you start thinking, well, it was John last time, it can't be John again because it's meant to be random. As soon as people start thinking like that, the mind gets in the way and it inhibits these abilities that we're studying. So the very nature of statistical tests inhibits the phenomenon you're studying. But nevertheless, for scientific reasons, you have to do such tests. It doesn't destroy it, but it inhibits it. The other thing is, of course, that very few things in biology are 100%. You know, when drug companies launch a new drug, it works for some people, it doesn't work for everyone. You know, when you have a sportsman who's brilliant, I mean a brilliant striker in soccer, for example, you know, it doesn't score goals in every single match. Someone who's good at cricket can score 100 runs sometimes, you know, but you can't say, well, they're going to score 100 in every single cricket match they take part in. So there's lots of things in life which are statistical and unpredictable, even weather forecasting. I mean, they give you probabilities of rain. They don't say, for sure, it's going to rain at 9 o'clock tomorrow morning. They don't know that. So almost everything in the real world, as opposed to very repeatable physical phenomena inside machines, that the real-world phenomena are very often statistical and don't give 100% certainty, but nevertheless, they exist. You know, the evidence for aspirins reducing heart attacks and things and improving long-term health, it's a tiny effect. It's a few percent above the control level, but nevertheless, you know, when you consider millions of people, it saves lots of lives. So this is normal in science, especially biology.
And that's something that I think is a bit disingenuous when it comes to the skeptics, because many of them have scientific knowledge. They know what's statistically significant and what isn't, but they throw up their hands and say, oh, you're not 100%, you're not 90%, you're not 80%, therefore it doesn't count. Or they throw it up as red herrings in the general public, who doesn't really have any awareness of statistical significance and that type of thing, says, oh, they must be right. And I do think that's disingenuous on the part of the debunkers.
Oh, yes. Well, the debunkers, they have an agenda. They have an ideological campaign. They're not really interested in the evidence. I've had many encounters with skeptics. They're interested in winning arguments. It's as if they're running a political campaign the whole time. You know, in political campaigns, we don't expect opponents to give a totally truthful assessment of the people they're opposing. They usually show them in the worst possible light. And skeptics will do anything to show this kind of research or these phenomena in the worst possible light, not because they're interested in the truth, but because they're not interested in the truth. They're interested in propagating an ideological agenda, which is really the philosophy of scientific materialism. And I don't think science needs to be wedded to that particular philosophy. That's the theme of my book, Science Set Free. I think that science should follow the facts and the evidence wherever it leads. And if it doesn't fit into the existing dogmatic worldview, then we need to broaden our worldview. So I think that many of the things that are called paranormal are in fact normal. And when we take them seriously, we realize that the world is a much richer and more interesting place. I think telepathy, you see, I think is a normal means of communication among animals within social groups. Wolves, for example, I think flocks of birds communicate telepathically with each other. And a lot of my work on telepathy has been done with animals, dogs, particularly dogs that know when their owners are coming home. So I think telepathy is very widespread in the animal kingdom. I think it's a normal means of communication.
One thing I do want to talk to you about, and I had personal experience with this just recently, unfortunately, is the idea that you sense when a loved one is sick or dying. And I'll give you my example. Back in April, I called my mom. She lived out of town. And called to see how she was doing about 9 o'clock at night. And then proceeded to watch some television or something. I was just in an awful mood, though, for some reason. I was just angry and I just chalked it up for being tired or whatever. But it wasn't that late. It was 9 o'clock in the evening. But I was incredibly upset, so much so that I said, you know what? I'm just going to go to bed because I'm just cranky and upset. About 3 hours, 3 or 4 hours later, I get the call that she's in cardiac arrest. And she died. There was no reason to, she had not been in fantastic health, but there was absolutely no reason to think that she had any impending death. She was not in a hospital. She was on some medication, but this was out of the blue, essentially. But it just struck me at how angry and upset I was. And I didn't specifically peg it towards her, but I just had this general feeling of dis-ease. Does this sound familiar to you? And talk a little bit about this idea of sensing when a loved one is sick or even worse, is about to die.
Well, I think it is actually perfectly normal, and there are many, many examples of this. Sometimes people think of the person who's dying by name, or they feel their presence. Sometimes they just feel a disturbance of mood, like you did, without knowing why. But I think this, again, is something that's pretty basic in telepathy. And I've been doing studies, which I describe in the sense of being stared at, of nursing mothers and their babies. And I think picking up distress of another person is really basic. What I've found is that many nursing mothers tell stories of knowing when their baby needs them when they're away from the baby. Their bodies respond, their breasts start squeezing out milk. It's called the milk letdown reflex. Normally it happens when they hear the baby cry, but if they're away from the baby and this reflex happens, most mothers think their baby needs them. And I've done studies with nursing mothers in England that show that actually they're amazingly correct in picking up when their baby needs them. And if you think about it, it makes total sense. A mother that had the ability to know when her baby needed her when she was away from the baby would have a baby that survived better than one that didn't know, because usually the mothers go to the baby when they're needed. Sure. So I think picking up distress of somebody we're bonded to is very, very basic, and I think it happens all the time when we're babies, that mothers, many mothers, can pick up our distress at a distance. And when kids grow up, it often goes on, usually more with the mothers than the fathers, the ability to know when they're in trouble or when something bad's happening to them. But for most of us, these bonds with people mean that when there's extreme cases of distress or when people are actually dying, people do often pick that up. But I would say that's at your own experience with your mother is at the kind of extreme end of a spectrum where the distress is extreme of someone dying. But in milder everyday cases like babies wanting to be fed, it happens on a regular basis. So I think this is one of the ways telepathy works. It alerts people to needs or things that, to needs or problems where they, and people can respond. Before the invention of telephones, this was the only way people had of knowing when they were needed at a distance. So for the vast majority of human history and in the history of all other animals, telepathy has served a very useful function. And I think that's one reason we have it. It's a normal part of our communication. In the modern world, we now have telephones, emails, and so forth, SMS messages. But interestingly, telepathy has evolved along with those. And so the commonest kinds in the modern world, as I mentioned earlier, in connection with phone calls, but also emails, SMS messages, instant messages, people somehow can feel when other people want to get in touch with them. They pick up their intention, which is why they often start thinking just before the call comes. If you're going to call someone, you have to intend to call them first. And I think that's what people pick up on telepathically.
Now, to pick on myself, I'll play skeptic a little bit. Now, a skeptic would hear my story, and they might say something like this. Well, Jim, I don't doubt that you felt very distressed, and unfortunately, what happened happened. However, there are probably plenty of times that you felt distressed after talking to your mom for whatever reason you felt distressed, and you just forgot about them. But you remember the hits, you forget the misses. And a lot of times, when we talk about psychics and different things, that's what the skeptics say. You remember the hits, you forget the misses. How would you respond to that?
Well, with people dying, you obviously can't do controlled experiments. So you can't have people die at random times so you can study statistically how many people pick it up. So in that case, you can't do an experiment. In the case of telephone telepathy, we have exactly the same situation. For 100 years since the telephone was invented, skeptics have said, oh, well, yes, people think about someone, then they ring, but you just remember the hits, you forget the misses, you just forget all the millions of times you think about other people and they don't ring. They've been saying that for 100 years. It's an evidence-free hypothesis. In science, you need not just a hypothesis, you need evidence. And these skeptics who say that kind of thing, if you say, well, where's your evidence? They don't actually have any. The telephone stuff, until I investigated, had never been investigated by anyone. But these skeptics had been making this pseudo-statistical argument for 100 years. But when you can do experiments, as you can with telephone telepathy, what you do is set up an experiment where you can actually exactly measure chance coincidence. In my experiment, which I mentioned with four callers, the chance of knowing who's calling at random would be 1 in 4, 25%. So we can actually give the chance coincidence value, which the skeptics think it's all to do with. And when we find the results are above the chance coincidence value, we can use standard statistics to find out just how improbable that is. And it turns out that the results are extremely significant. So testing the skeptical theory requires statistical experimental tests. Theirs is basically a statistical theory. They're saying, yes, it happens sometimes by coincidence, but then you forget the times it doesn't work. Well, in the case of telephone and email and text message telepathy, and I've done experiments on all of those, which are described in my book, The Sense of Being Stared At, it's not just chance coincidence because we've actually tested it scientifically. So if the skeptics say that, they're being unscientific, they're being pseudo-scientific by putting forward a seemingly sophisticated argument, but one for which they have no evidence.
And Before we go, Dr. Sheldrake, I know you were mentioning a project that you're working on that's near and dear to your heart, and it sounds pretty fascinating as it relates to examining the skeptics.
Yes, well, you see, the problem with skeptics is they're not real skeptics, most of them. Real skeptics are open to evidence, and there's skepticism, an attitude of doubt, but openness. Nothing wrong with that. I mean, anyone who's scientific is a skeptic. We have to be skeptical about things. We just don't take everything on trust or engage in credulousness. But ideological skeptics have a big agenda. They want to discredit all paranormal phenomena, like telepathy, because they want to maintain a taboo, a materialist worldview. I've helped set up, with others, a website called Skeptical Investigations. It's www.skepticalinvestigations.org, O-R-G, in which we investigate skeptics. And what we show is that many of these so-called skeptics are not really skeptics at all. They're ideologically driven. They have a fixed belief system. They're simply not scientifically credible. So anyone who's had problems with skeptics and wants to see more about where they're coming from and what these various skeptical organizations are doing should take a look at skepticalinvestigations.org. There's a great deal of information there. And it helps in dealing with skeptics when you realize that they're not really interested in the evidence. That's not what they're doing. They're trying to score points. It's like it's as if they're trying to win an election to take over the scientific world or the world view of the population through any means, fair or foul. But the true scientific attitude is to be open to evidence. And so what I'm in favor of is true science, not pseudo-skepticism.
Well, thank you for telling us about that. That sounds fascinating and sounds like something that is high time to come into place. So we're so glad to hear about it. Well, it's been a fascinating discussion. Our guest has been Dr. Rupert Sheldrake. Dr. Sheldrake, where can people find The Sense of Being Stared At in your other books, and where can they follow all of your work and keep up with the fascinating studies that you're doing?
Well, The Sense of Being Stared At in a completely revised new edition has just been published, and it should be in bookstores and, of course, is available online. And so are my other books. The one that's most recent is Science Set Free, and that's regularly available in shops and online. And my work is described on my website, www.sheldrake.org. That's a good place for people who want to learn more about what I'm doing to go. There's a huge amount of information there, all freely available. And so that's where to turn. But the book itself, The Sense of Being Stared At and Other Unexplained Powers of Human Minds, covers a range of phenomena based on the natural history of everyday events, telepathy, premonitions, and the sense of being stared at, together with experimental data on all these things. So many people find that their own life has many examples of these things in it already, and it sheds a new light on their own experience.
Thank you so much for joining us today on the Paranormal Podcast.
It's my pleasure.
And thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed the show as much as I did. This has been fascinating. Hope you'll go over to iTunes or on your podcasts app on your iPhone or iPad and rate the show and give us a 2 or 3 sentence review. It really helps. We'll talk to you next time on the Paranormal Podcast. Thanks so much. Now for the legal disclaimer. We do not accept money from publishers or content producers in exchange for interviews. However, as with most media outlets, in the majority of cases, we do receive complimentary copies of books and DVDs that we feature on our podcasts. Your purchases of books, DVDs, and other items via our Amazon.com links benefit Jim Harold and JimHarold.com and help us continue our programming. The sponsor messages you hear on the programs are paid endorsements, although We really do like them. For the full disclaimer, go to jimherold.com, and thanks for listening.